Five, four, three, two, one. I'm John Miglosh for the Wisconsin DMA and the International Society for Strategic Marketing. Now we've got an interesting article to kick it off called Why the Digital Era Isn't the End for Print Marketing. But one of the interesting things is this is further education news in the UK, and I hadn't heard of that, and it's a very credible organization, I found out, and Alicia Walker does a nice job of talking about alternatives to digital. Digital continues to grow, good point, but we're all learning to avoid it. So if you're looking for ways to market your brand, don't necessarily pitch all your tents within the digital landscape. There's still success to be found in other promotional techniques. One reason is banner blindness. We focus our attention, you know, we're so inundated on the digital channel that we don't pay attention to the sides anymore. And I even have buttons that take all that stuff off. That's how I get such nice print copies of the articles, right? So, and here's a funny illustration. According to the way digital promotes itself, you can hit people right when they're in the market. And this means your business can focus its time, attention, and money on promoting its products only to people that have the potential to buy them. For example, a seller of wedding suits would be able to target male customers that are engaged. You're kidding, right? Alicia, you must be single. You haven't planned a wedding yet. Nobody lets the groom pick the outfit. Nobody. I didn't, and nobody does. You know, the bride says, well, we're going to have purple as the theme color, and then the groom gets a black suit or a tux or something, and, you know, everything. It's all done by the bride. So promoting to the men would be a total waste of money, I just have to say. But, you know, anyway, banner blindness is where the customers may consciously or subconsciously ignore banner-like content on social media, right? Okay. According to one study, and I always love that because I couldn't get the study to come up, but maybe it could if you read the original, 86% of consumers suffer from banner blindness. That's a lot. That's almost all of them. And who knows if the other men who are looking at it, only 14% of those engaged men will actually take notice of it. Probably not. Almost 100% not. Okay. In this respect, print marketing has a significant advantage. 75% of direct mail receivers are able to recall the brands. Well, that's pretty good. Okay. Trust is key. Alicia points out that digital is sharing your data. And, you know, also you get targeted when you have no interest in it at all. Like the example you gave, like if I'm got engaged and I'm a man, I don't have any interest in the suit. I'd be more interested in the bridal gown that my wife, prospective wife, my fiance is wearing, but I don't get to see that until the day of the wedding. So that's tough, you know. I happen to take care of the honeymoon destination, but, you know, that was about it. Only 42% of people trust online advertising, while 61% say they trust advertising in newspapers. I haven't looked at a newspaper in a long time, but here I think it boils down to this. Print is an investment, and therefore businesses that use this method are well-founded and trustworthy. Paper speaks louder than pixels. And one of the things that I noticed long ago was that catalogs especially, you know, are a formidable barrier to entry. When you have the best catalog in a market, you know, that's not going to be duplicated by up-and-comers, not anytime soon. They'd never even attempt it because the logistics are just so challenging. When Wayfair started theirs, they said, we didn't realize we had to buy the paper beforehand. We thought the printer handled that. Well, they do, except you pay a lot more if you can buy the paper. Like 6 months in advance, you know, we didn't know what we were going to sell 6 months in advance, right? It's a lot of work. It's a lot. Okay, make a statement, not a whisper. And Alicia talks about how billboards, and I'm noticing that that billboards are where a lot of digital advertisers, a lot of digital dot-coms are advertising. There's two DuckDuckGo ads in a row, and then on the other side of the freeway, there's an Amazon sign. I'm not kidding. And TikTok advertised right in the middle of Times Square and the middle of Piccadilly Circus. So no matter what digital tells you, it's hard to scale with digital. You got to get out of digital to get people to come to your site. It's pretty much as simple as that. But Alicia points to a billboard for Dracula, the BBC series, where wooden stakes were planted into the billboard in almost sporadic fashions. I'll show that to you in a second. During the day, the billboard appears intriguing at best. Now let's go over and see the Dracula. Okay, here's what it looks like during the day. Some people were confused when they saw this during the daytime. But just wait till it gets dark. And here it goes, getting darker, getting darker. You can see this light's coming on. And then here comes the face, and there's the face. Now, what's clear to me is that these stakes, unlike Alicia's perspective, these stakes do not generate this face. My guess is that the face is actually generated by, a piece of opaque like metal or plastic or something on the side of this light that blocks the light this way, because it has that kind of projection, you know, where it's looking like it's narrower on the left side and gets wider. So it's probably right there. Now, you can't do these teeth with just a bunch of stakes. You'd have to have them curved and stuff, and you know, I'm sure that's not the case, and observers pointed that out. But nevertheless, it is quite dramatic, and it kind of looks like that's what's going on. But it wouldn't be precise enough for that, I don't think. Okay? Don't think you could get it to curve inwards in the same way. But who knows? Maybe it's possible. Anyway, back to Alicia. Okay, so that's pretty much it. She says there's a lot of good stuff. Your business should never have to choose between both digital and print. Combined, effective print marketing along with intelligent digital publications can lead to business success. And I would say that we're hearing more and more about companies saying, let's try mail. It's more scalable. And I'm working on a startup, and we're doing just that. Okay, I want to get to this article most. This is in Wired, and it's really good. It's called The Neuroscience... Accepting Defeat, The Neuroscience of Screwing Up. And I'm going to just hit the high points best I can. I want to invite you to go over to WDMA.org down below, WDMA.org, and subscribe, because every day I post the articles that I've covered and marked up. You get this exact marked up show notes. And this one is worth a long time read. You'll notice it's 20 to 25 minutes, which I'd love to take and read it to you, but I'm not going to. So these two scientists were trying to make a radio telescope, and they kept getting this weird static sound. And they tried all kinds of calibrations and amplifiers, but it just wasn't working. There was a persistent background noise that interfered with all of their observations. And the fallout, they thought it maybe it was New York City nearby, but when they aimed it another way, it didn't matter, or when they aimed it right at it, it didn't matter. They thought maybe nuclear bomb tests had caused it, but that didn't make any sense, because as the fallout faded, when I was growing up in grade school, we had weather reports that told us how much the fallout was going to be. Think about that. Okay. There were pigeons, a pair of birds were roosting on the narrow part of the receiver, leaving a trail of white dielectric material. I think that might have been the bird poop, the guano. Anyway, there was all kinds of stuff. And so that's the beginning of the article. And they tried to ignore the noise, but the noise always remained, making it impossible to find the faint echoes they were looking for. Their telescope was a failure. The point of this article is partly that experiments rarely tell us what we expect. That's the dirty little secret, according to Christopher wall. There's beware of just conformity, reproving the same old stuff. Examine the failure and search for out. Well, anyway. So I have a master's degree in philosophy of science, so I knew about all these people. But there's this guy, Kevin Dunbar, and he decided that philosophers have been theorizing about how science happens. But scientists often don't think the way the textbooks say they are. Philosophy of science is about as useful to scientists as ornithology is to birds. Ornithology, of course, is the study of birds, but birds don't care, right? And scientists don't basically care. And my whole life, I've been talking to scientists off and on, and they don't think about philosophy of science. They don't think about how they prove what they prove. They set up experimental tests. They have a pretty good idea of the nature of experimental tests, isolating causal variables and all that. But they expect it to turn out the way they expect. But what Kevin found out after years of following scientists around, found out that Dunbar said, science is a deeply frustrating pursuit. More than 50% of their data was unexpected, and in some labs, more than 75% was unexpected. Scientists had elaborate theories about what was supposed to happen, but the results kept contradicting their theories. The best scientific theories are really only hypotheses, and they try their darndest not to let any disconfirming evidence get in the way. I also have an undergrad in history of science, and the story of science is mainly the story of repression of counter evidence. Yes, but the breakthroughs come when some of it sneaks through and somebody looks at it in a different way. The scientists were looking for X, but they found Y. Now, what happens? Yeah, and Thomas Kuhn, 20th century philosopher, said everything but the most esoteric detail of the results should be known in advance. Right. Yeah, that's not true, though. That's not the way it works. Not if you're on the cutting edge. Nowhere. This idealized version of the lab fell apart, replaced by an endless supply of disappointing surprises. There were models that didn't work, data that couldn't be replicated, and simple studies riddled with anomalies. These weren't sloppy people. They were working with some of the finest labs in the world, but the experiments rarely tell us what we think they're going to tell us. That's the dirty secret of science. Now, I get a kick out of that. It's sort of a hobby of mine, finding these kinds of anomalies. What do they do? Well, first they blame the method. And then, usually, after trying lots of stuff, the weirdness remains. Read G.K. Chesterton on the Ethics of Elfland in Orthodoxy. He says there's always a weirdness. No, he calls it a wildness. He says the world is obviously logical, but it's never quite logical. It never behaves the way we expect. Chesterton, the great thinker. Okay, scientists, oftentimes, people have to pick and choose what they're interested in, and often they choose badly. And oftentimes, they just throw it away, right? And part of this is the way our brains work. We carefully edit our reality, searching for evidence that confirms what we already believe. That may be part of the banner blindness that you just read about. The problem with science, then, isn't that most experiments fail. It's that most failures are ignored. Right. It's always the anomalies. And that's why when we pioneered machine learning with marketing, we always set it up to find anomalies. Our system spots anomalies. And the greatest multi-million-dollar breakthroughs we found were when the model clearly was wrong. And you can read about that in my book, especially the first story about Cabela's, which was really our first big mailer that used our system. And we found recency didn't work for them at all in our model. And I called a PhD statistician friend, and I said, what do you think? He said, your model's wrong, your data's wrong, something's wrong. Exactly the same, right? He says, because recency's always the top. No, it isn't. We found out why. It was a huge breakthrough for them, okay? That's the way it's supposed to work. So anyway, Dunbar tried his own experiment. He showed the Galileo experiment of dropping different sized cannonballs off the Tower of Pisa. And if you're a philosophy of history or a history of science major, you know this, right? That you know if you take a really big ball and a really little ball, the big ball goes faster because it's heavier. Kaboom, right? No. I mean, air might play a little bit of a factor, depending on, but if they're really heavy, like a cannonball, air won't matter. And that's why it's so great. So Dunbar showed this footage and asked untrained undergrads, and they, of course, he showed them one movie where the balls are coming at the same speed and another one where the bigger ball is going faster. And the untrained students accepted the bigger ball theory and said that one reflects gravity best. And the trained students said, no, we know better than that. They're both going to accelerate at the same rate, right, which they do. So anyway, there's a blocker in there that knocks the other one out. It's called the ACC, which is also called the oh shit circuit. And it's somewhere in here. There's this, oh, the anterior cingulate cortex. And it blocks stuff and says, wait, that's wrong. Or it gets or causes a reaction. But then there's also the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Dorsolateral. Okay, I know what that means. Okay, it's like the dorsal fin on a dolphin. It's located just behind the forehead. One of the last brain areas to develop in young adults. So when physics students watched the two videos, they easily got this, got the DLPFC rejected the wrong one because they knew better, right? But when the ACC and the DLPFC turn on together, people aren't just noticing that something doesn't look right. They're also inhibiting information. We reject. We don't just miss it. We say, that doesn't exist. The disconfirmation. And, you know, I've been working on these things. I've been working on disconfirmation facts my entire life. I enjoy it for some reason. It's probably a brain injury I had when I was a child. But people will not listen to alternative data or alternative explanations that go with the data that better encapsulate the disconfirmation. So now you know why. It doesn't work. I know it didn't work. I didn't know you could argue somebody into, you know, into belief from atheism or something. You know, better off buying them a sandwich and listening to why they think what they think. But we're not talking about persuasion here. We're talking about the human mind. There's actually circuits in the human mind that will war against it. So if you're trying to pitch direct mail in a company that is all in digital, and I've done it, and I've lost lots of clients because they were all in digital, and when they go under, that's too bad. Tried. But anyway, belief, in other words, is a kind of blindness. So how do you learn from failure? Don't just think maybe the data is wrong. Maybe the hypothesis is wrong. When I talked with a PhD statistician, I said, okay, that makes sense. Recency is always the most powerful variable. But he wasn't working with the same level of variables we were. He was working with a handful and doing regression modeling. We were doing machine learning, and he, I don't think, had done that very much. And so we could see into stuff. And we were trying to mail the fishermen. And it was December that we were pulling the names and doing the model because that's when the model had been pulled the year before. Who are the most recent names in December? The hunters. And that bit of insight changed the entire way Cabela's thought about mailing their customers. And you can read the book. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's basically it. Seek out the ignorant. You know, I tried to explain this stuff to Dick Cabela, and he was very smart. in Street Smarts, but he was, but he wasn't a statistician. Encourage diversity. If everyone working on the problem speaks the same language, then everyone has the same set of assumptions. That is absolutely false. In fact, in today's communication world, I'm not sure language would matter much at all. It's more about economic status, level of education, upbringing, a lot of other things. That's the trouble with diversity. Diversity tends to be picked by the people in charge who have a certain view of diversity. Their view is not diverse, and then they hire people of that opinion. It's very difficult to get people diverse opinions in this world because our minds don't like it. Oh, my goodness. And this Thorsten Verbalen guy, he wrote an article about Jewish intellectual productivity when Einstein was getting the Nobel Prize and a bunch of other guys were doing really well. And he said, not only didn't persecution of the Jews not hinder their intellectual integrity and productivity, but it actually pushed it forward. The fact that Jews were perpetual outsiders gave them a skeptical animus. They were able to question everything. If Einstein had gotten tenure at an elite German university, he would have become just another physics professor with a vested interest in the space-time status quo. Probably true. I've never been status quo. I got kicked out of the Direct Marketing Association 3 times. Blackballed. Not allowed to speak again. And I think that probably happened with USPS. I'm not sure. I never did find out. And oftentimes you don't. You say a couple of crazy things. Verbalen was a Lutheran from Wisconsin, so I highlighted that because we're the Wisconsin DMA. But there are advantages to thinking on the margin, and that's what you get every day on the show. Subscribe at WDMA.org. It's free. Or join and support our efforts, and you will find thinking out on the margin that will challenge you and perhaps give you multi-million dollar breakthroughs. Have a great day. Like and share. Your friends will know you're smart. Bye-bye.